Okay, so what we're going to do here, this is image number 9 on your handout. This dash line kind of represents the Great Plains, and we're going to assume that all in terms of soil forming factors, things are pretty much the same except for climate. And you can see the mean annual precipitation gradient as you go east-west. The yellow colors indicate the drier climates, and it gets moister as you head eastward. The top figure there, average temperature, not surprising, pretty strong gradient as you go north-south with cooler temperatures up north. And so what we're going to do is look at a couple of soils that come from this area and are examples of these, of one of the precipitation gradient and the temperature gradient. Okay, this first one is two profiles, one from New Mexico and one from North Dakota. So these reflect the temperature gradient. Let's just assume all other factors are equal, okay? Precip's about the same. And in fact, if you go back and look at this map, you can see North Dakota up there, precip here, North Dakota and New Mexico, not a whole lot of difference there. You've got roughly the same amount of annual precip. So looking at those two soil profiles, which one has more organic matter? The one from North Dakota. Okay, and the reason would be what? Let's say the climate, the precip is the same.
But if the timing is different.
Let's say that's the same. We're just going to kind of keep this simple.
Vegetation.
Well, let's say the vegetation is grasses, native grasses throughout the whole thing. Obviously, it'd be a little bit different. But what's going to be the biggest difference between those two sites? You get the same amount of moisture for precip. Yeah, evapotranspiration is definitely going to figure into it. But what you're probably seeing, if we assume that the net biomass production, both those areas, is going to be similar, then why do we get more organic matter accumulating in North Dakota?
It breaks down slower.
It breaks down slower because of cooler temperatures and reduced microbial activity. So what we're actually seeing is a direct effect of temperature on that transformation of plant material to soil organic matter. And you know, this is kind of an ongoing process, and the whole thing is slowed down in North Dakota, and we end up with just a higher equilibrium level of organic carbon. And temperature by itself is a pretty important determinant of what that organic matter level is going to be. Okay, now if we look at the gradient, look at the precip gradient from eastern Colorado to eastern Iowa. And there we've got similar temperatures, but we have a big difference in mean annual precipitation. Eastern Colorado would be about 15 inches. Eastern Iowa would be about 30 inches. And looking at those two soil profiles, which one has the most organic matter? Yeah, Iowa. It's got a darker A horizon up there and just darker colors in general. But why would that be? All other factors being equal, or roughly equal. More precip, more biomass production. So if you think back to this idea of the temperature and the precip, by combining those things, you've got this really strong control over soil organic matter levels, because the climate, again, precip and temperature, largely define how much biomass production there is, and also the rate at which it turns over and is cycled through, or transformed into humus and that type of thing. So it's really the combination of those that largely determines soil organic matter levels. And we're looking at a pretty simplistic example, but I think you can kind of get the idea of how these things might interact. There's a figure in your book that is based on a rangeland study that was done in Montana back in the late 1970s. Really cool study, and this is a complicated graph. So I'll just see if I can walk you through it. Up top we have the kilograms per hectare of annual range production. Okay, this is just the above-ground biomass that gets produced on site. And then this is the ground surface, and down here we've got depth in the soil. Now, what this study did was it looked at rangeland production and soil properties across a pretty wide, really a bioclimatic range of soils in Montana and the foothills. And one of the characteristics is that there's a pretty pronounced dry to moist gradient. In other words, when you're out in the lower lying areas, they're pretty dry. When you get up into the foothills, you start to increase the amount of annual precip. And along with this, you probably get a temperature change too, warmer to cooler. But notice this curve, forget all this classification stuff in here, but this curve up here represents annual productivity. So the relationship there, as you increase annual precip, what happens to above ground productivity? It goes up, all right? Not too surprising. But look at what's going on below ground, all right? Two curves here. This one is the thickness of the malic epipedon. And all that is, well, we'll talk more about a malic epipedon, but it is the thick, dark surface horizon that defines mollisols, or a lot of the grassland soils. See the relationship between annual productivity and the thickness of the malic epipedon? As you increase productivity, what happens to the epipedon? It gets thicker. In other words, more organic matter there. And then this other curve is the depth of calcium carbonate. And as you go from dry to moist, we already talked about this, what happens to the depth at which you find calcium carbonate? Well, it increases because of the decalcification, calcification thing. Well, there are a lot of you that are in range here. How many of you have done clip plots on rangeland?
Like biomass
plots? Yeah. Is it a lot of work?
Yes.
And you're in the hot sun. It's a lot of work. And one of the things that was found in this study is that the annual productivity, yeah, you can go out there and you can clip these plots for, these were done for a couple of years in average. It was a tremendous amount of work. Or, if you're lazy, here's another suggestion. There is a very strong correlation between the thickness of the malic epipedon and this mean annual productivity, and also the depth to calcium carbonate and mean annual productivity. So you're starting to see this interaction between organic matter levels and climatic parameters. And I guess the way I think of this is the depth to calcium carbonate is kind of a fossil record of the amount of translocation or this decalcification, calcification that's been going on in this soil. And you get a certain amount of precipitation, you get a certain degree of wetting down to a particular depth, and that's what drives this, where you find the carbonates appearing. And similarly, the malic epipedon is a fossil record of the balance between past productivity and decomposition on that site. So the more productive sites have thick malic epipedon. Now, we kind of get into a chicken and egg argument here. Are they more productive because they've got a thick malic epipedon? I'd argue no. In this case, the soils and the plant communities co-evolve. And these out here are productive sites, and the thick malic epipedon just is a good indicator that it's a very productive site. So, at least for my money, I'd much rather go out and measure the thickness of a malic epipedon or the depth of calcium carbonate, because it's a lot easier. But it does indicate that you can use soil morphological characteristics to infer a lot of things about the plant productivity at a site and even past production as well. Really cool study, and here are a couple images from it. This is one of the lower productivity sites. It's warm and dry. I don't remember the precip here. I think it's about 6 or 7 inches a year. There's not much growing there. Pretty lousy range, and if you look at the soil profile, do you see anything that looks like an A horizon in there? Not really, and there's no, there's nothing that I would clearly recognize as an A horizon. There may be a little bit of organic matter accumulation, but okay, and if we go to the other end of the spectrum and increase the annual productivity threefold to about 1,500, this is up in the foothills, look at the soil that you get all of a sudden a really dark, thick, dark surface horizon. And again, reflective of the past productivity of the site and the decomposition. So a really nice relationship between these things. Any questions about this?
Do scientists already know this, or do they just go like...
What's that?
Do they just like to take biomass plots?
Well, I'd like to think that ranch people, to a large extent, pay attention to the soils. And I will give them credit for that. Foresters haven't always done it, but they're kind of coming around. But I guess the point is, as I mentioned a couple class periods ago, soils are such good integrators of all of these processes that are going on at the soil surface that there's a lot of information that is contained there, and I think it's up to us to kind of figure out how we can use it. So maybe it'll tell us something about productivity, and I think it clearly does. It tells us something about climate, and there's a lot of information to be gained from it. Okay, I want to move on and talk about organisms a little bit. And this is the next soil forming factor. And when we think about organisms, there's really three things that we generally consider. One, and probably the most important, is we think about plant community. Whether it's forest, whether it's grassland, what grows there. And just be aware that it's important, but it's not the only aspect of organisms we need to consider, because there's a bunch of animals, the soil-dwelling organisms, earthworms, insects, cicadas, all kinds of things. And we finally get down to the level of microbes. And microbes are important too. I mean, they're the heavy lifters when you get into this whole decomposition process. So we really need to consider all three of these when we're talking about the effect of organisms on soil formation. Well, the main effects on soil formation and morphology, the first one is going to be just the inputs of organic matter and then the decomposition of those organic matter inputs. And we've already talked a little bit about this, but it's primarily the plant community that furnishes the or provides the inputs of organic matter, and then it's the microbes that are engaged with the decomposition side of things, as well as some of the other soil-dwelling organisms. They all participate. And then, as part of this, we have this biogeochemical cycling, nutrient cycling, which in some soils is extremely important, and that's where the majority of the available nutrients are going to be found as you take this organic matter production and decomposition. And then finally, the weathering, and just chemical weathering of the minerals that we find in the soil is often promoted by the activity of microbes. I'll show you a couple of examples. So we looked at this earlier, the distribution of soil orders, the potential natural vegetation, and again, broad relationships between the two. Shouldn't be surprising. And I want to talk a little bit about two basic extremes in terms of plant communities, a grassland community and a forest community, okay? Let's talk about a grassland first of all. This is a pretty famous study that was done in the prairies in North Dakota. And what they did was measure the annual above ground biomass production and below ground biomass production. You want to talk about a tedious undertaking, this would be it. You ever tried to measure annual root production? I don't know how you do it, but I think I take the number with a grain of salt. But look at the difference here, above ground versus below ground. Where is most of the biomass production? It's below ground, okay? And here's another, that's a temperate region. Here's an alpine grassland in the Alps. Above ground, 300 grams of carbon per square meter, below ground, about 1,200 grams of carbon per square meter. Same pattern there, much greater below ground production. And I think when you get in some of these water limited environments and maybe a little more extreme environments, plants tend to focus their resources below ground rather than above ground. So the net result is most of the carbon inputs are going to be in the form of roots. Okay? And so very important to keep in mind, because we've talked about the processes associated with roots. Now, when we think about forests, this is a big study that was done across Canada. And you know, Canada is a big country, and there's a lot of climatic variation there. They looked at a bunch of their forest types and some other biomes here, but boreal forests, Cordilleran forests, grassland, Pacific, the whole range. And what they were doing was looking at, just focus your attention over here. This is the above ground biomass and the root biomass. So here's the kind of the zero point. And you look at most of these forest communities, Pacific, Cordilleran, Interior, Cordilleran, and so on, you can see that the vast majority of the production now is above ground, and relatively small amount is below ground for all of these forest types. And I think over here they're actually calculating the proportion below ground for it. And you can see that it's about 20% by and large. I take that number with a little bit of a range. And it varies a little bit whether it's hardwood or softwood. But as a general rule of thumb, if you think about a forest environment, maybe about 80% above ground biomass production, 20% below ground, and you could pretty much reverse that for the grassland, where it's about 80% below ground and only about 20% above ground. So you've got two very different mechanisms by which carbon is being added to the soil. And let's see what that looks like. So if you think about a forest with a litter layer, you've got a lot of organic matter there, but it's not really in the soil. It's sitting at the top of the soil, right? Now, there are organisms that come up and grab this stuff and pull it down into the soil, and there's mechanisms that you can get it into the soil, but a lot of it just sits up there in a litter layer and slowly decomposes or is transformed. And if you look at a typical grassland profile, a typical forest profile like you see here, this is pretty good representation of what you might see in terms of horizons. Notice in the grassland profile on the left, the dark colors going down to, well, more than 2 feet because of all the root production. The forest profile, looks like there's probably an O horizon up there, but you don't really see much darkening or melanization once you get down below, it says half a foot or 6 inches. And this is very typical that most forest soil profiles do not have a well-expressed A horizon, whereas grassland soils do. And the reason is simply the inputs of carbon, whether it's roots or above ground litter. So one thing to keep in mind, and of course you get things in between, but this more or less represents the extremes. And here's another example of how vegetation is going to affect the soil characteristics. This is a wetland soil from northern Idaho, and it's actually a peat soil, so one that you'd find out in a bog. We'd call it a histosol. It's an organic soil. And what's the parent material of that soil? It's peat. It's going to be mosses and then very similar plants. So in this case, you're looking at an extreme example where the plant is really providing the parent material for the soil. Okay, so the plants are directly responsible for the soil characteristics there, and in this case, an organic soil. Another similar example, but in a very different environment, that was a wetland. This is an extremely dry area down in Craters of the Moon in south central Idaho. And I don't know if you've ever been down there. If you haven't, it's a cool place to go, but a lot of these fairly young basalt lava flows. And from a distance, they don't really look like there's much on them. But if you look carefully, and you get into some of the depressional areas on top of the basalt flows and cracks, you'll find these little shallow organic soils that have formed exclusively from the litter of the various plants. So imagine this, you've got a crack in the basalt or a little bit of a depression. Some plant, and these plants are tough because it's a harsh environment, they're able to take hold and they get established. Maybe they can extract a little bit of deeper water. I don't know what they're, how they're doing it, but each year they're going to have litter drop. It's going to fall on top of here. Some of it's going to decompose, and at least in many cases, there's actually a net accumulation of litter. So over time, the area and the volume of this soil is increasing a little bit. And then it gets big enough that maybe a grass seed's going to blow in there and take root, and you're going to have a grass plant and maybe another plant. And over time, you can imagine these organic soils actually starting to cover the entire surface of the lava flow, and then they can collect dust or trap dust, and you actually have the start of formation of soil. So plants are pioneers. They're really good at establishing themselves in some pretty tough spots, and left to their own resources, they produce their own soil. We talked about glaciation as one of these specific soil-forming processes. Well, here you see it written out. You have iron 3+, which is the oxidized form, gains an electron. We reduce it to iron 2+, and the iron 3+ is what we think about with red and yellow and brown types of colors. The iron 2+, when it's reduced, that's what we associate with these gray colors, or these grayish, very dull types of colors. Well, I mentioned this morning, this process is, we maybe don't just at the surface think of it in terms of organisms, but where does that electron come from that reduces that iron? Well, if we want to think about this simply, microbes, exactly. And microbes are a lot like us. In order to, when they oxidize substrates and are going about their metabolism, they generate electrons and they need to dump them, okay? And in most soils, oxygen is where is the electron acceptor. But if you've got a waterlogged soil, there's not going to be much oxygen in it, and iron is used as an alternative electron acceptor. And that's why you'll see the formation of these gray colors, whether it's the example in the upper left-hand corner where you've got a little bit of the oxidized iron there, the more orangish-looking stuff, or this one where it's pretty much reduced throughout the entire profile in those gray colors. So this is a microbially mediated process. And it's the microbes that are in that soil that are reducing the iron and causing the formation of that glaze color, or so this glaciation process. So if I ask you on a test, what would be an example of a soil horizon formed by an organism? You could say, how about a BG horizon? Because it's the microbes that are doing it, right? Another cool example, this was something that there's a tree in New Zealand known as the kauri tree, and these are huge trees. Some of them are thousands of years old, but we talked a little bit about podzolization and the formation of an E horizon and then a BHS horizon underneath it. Well, what happens under these kauri trees, like I said, the older ones are gigantic, but there was a kauri tree growing right here, and over time, what happens is it develops this litter cone up against the base of the tree. And because of the litter and some of the compounds that are coming out of that litter, they are very effective chelators. So they hook up with the aluminum and iron and move it downward in the soil. So what you're seeing here is what people refer to as a basket podzol or a basket spodosol. And here's the E horizon. Dips down here and then comes back up. And this is the BHS horizon. This white area is the E horizon. And it's really a reflection of that litter cone and all of those organic compounds that are moving into the soil and chelating the iron and aluminum and moving them downward. So a real good example of where you find a specific soil associated with a specific type of tree. What do we call these guys? Lichen, which are symbiotic relationships between a fungus and an alga. And I think you can also have some threesomes in there with cyanobacteria that they're finding. But anyway, the point is that this is, you can look at bare rock and these lichens are probably going to be the first pioneering organism that is going to establish there before you get any kind of a vascular plant. And as a result of their metabolism, these lichens secrete different types of organic acids, which start to chemically weather the rock material. And as they do, that rock starts to break down. Maybe you get a few sand grains there. The sand grains trap a little bit finer sediment, and you're on your way to getting a soil form. So in an awful lot of cases in rocky terrain, these lichens might represent the first stage of soil formation. So another example of plant pioneers. This figure's out of your book, and it does nothing more than really show you the variety of organisms that you find in the soil and the incredible numbers of these things that you find in the soil. This scale over here is the number per square meter, and you can see here's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. So what's 10 to the 12? Yeah, we're getting into these numbers that, you know, 10 to the 6th is a million, and 10 to the 9th is going to be a trillion, 10 to the 12th. You know, we're getting in some really large, a billion, and then 10 to the 12th be trillion. So we're getting in huge numbers of these things. And of course, these are the bacteria, actinomycetes, fungi, those types of things, algae, the really small organisms. But look at all these other guys, protozoan, these nematodes, Calambula, Rotifera, all these different organisms. There's still lots and lots of these things. Earthworms have a major role in many soils. This is the good old night crawler, but you know, these things eat their way through the soil, and one of their contributions is that they come up, they grab litter, and they bring it down into the soil. So this is one mechanism where you get forest floor actually incorporated into the, physically mixed into the upper part of the soil. These guys do it, and in the process you can see all the earthworm turds up there on the top, and this is something that as they process the soil material you end up with, this is a byproduct, and it creates a little microenvironment that a lot of plants tend to like. Has anybody ever seen leaf cutter ants? Well, these are pretty fascinating things. They pick plants, and these ants come, and they cut these leaves, they cut chunks of them, and then they pick them up, and they march back to a big underground nest. And here you see one of the ants carrying a big, these guys are strong. And then, interestingly enough, there's quite a social structure with these things, but you notice the ants that are riding on there? I originally thought, well, they're just freeloaders. They're lazy and they just along for the ride. But it turns out they're actually guard ants. And the idea is if another ant from a different colony tries to steal that leaf fragment, then these guys jump off and take care of them, I guess. That's the idea. But there will be long strings of these things marching through the forest. And what they're doing is taking the above ground leaf material and bringing it down below ground. So it's another mechanism by which we're taking plant material and moving it into the soil.
Are they actually like farming them?
Well, they do. The idea is they take the leaf material back, and they're cultivating a particular fungus. And this is all for the queen. You know, go figure, but we've got some pretty odd social setups too. But it really represents a lot of decomposition and this above ground material getting it into the soil. Because some of these leaf cutter, I don't know what the correct term, but their caverns in the soil are huge. I mean, they'll be the size of a small room. So it's a tremendous amount of activity. This is a plaster cast of an ant mound. And what somebody did is they found an ant mound and they poured plaster of Paris in it and let it harden, and then they carefully excavated the thing. And it's a pretty good example of the elaborate network of tunnels going from the soil surface down into the soil. And we haven't talked a whole lot about water movement, but if you're looking for potential preferential flow pathways and movement of water through a soil, you know, these ants are really doing a pretty important job of engineering the hydrology in this particular soil. And it's usually, it's not always a good thing. In fact, in this case, I think they were trying to figure out why they were finding pesticides in the groundwater. And they ended up blaming the ants because of these this extensive network of tunnels. But remember the term bioturbation? You know, just a lot of physical mixing of the soil material. Anybody ever seen these things, MEMA mounds? Know anything about them, Kendall?
Just heard they're really disputed.
Yeah, these are over near Olympia, and it's probably there's actually a MEMA mound state park, I think it is. But these things are this very regular pattern of these mounds out on a very flat landscape, and these things might be about 6 feet in the center. And then you get out in between them, and there's a huge amount of relief. And there's been a lot of argument about how do these things form. And one of the widely held theories is that they're a result of burrowing animals. But I don't know if it's true, but you know, they attribute the formation of these mounds to these gophers and other types of burrowing animals taking this material and piling it up. And I'm not sure I buy the whole thing, but you can see some similar things if you go up on Paradise Ridge, even Kamiak Butte, some of the other higher points around here. You'll see very similar features where you've got these mounds and intermounds. And usually the mound is a fairly deep soil, and these intermounds, you have extremely shallow soils, down to bedrock or you know, real gravelly layers, something like that. And I think what's happened is people have done studies where they go dig up a mound and they find a lot of burrowing animals in there. So it's I'd say the burrowing animals are definitely associated with the mounds, but whether they cause them, that might be another issue. If I was burrowing, I think I'd pick the deeper soil, personally.
We saw a bunch of those down in south of Boise on field.
Yeah, they're all over southern Idaho too, and they've been interpreted in a variety of ways. Some people think that you know, it's a biological phenomenon. I guess they've duplicated something similar in a laboratory using seismic shaking, where if you take wet sediment and then subject it to shaking, you kind of get that same sort of a formation. Some people think they're paraglacial features, so that's a good way to start an argument. I'm talking about those. Termites. Termites are all over the world. We think about them as eating up the wooden structure of our house, but they're on, I think they're every continent but Antarctica. And just to give you an idea of how much soil these guys are going to disturb, and again, they're taking plant material and they're going into the soil and bringing that stuff in these huge nests, or what I guess they're called termite nests or mounds. You take a cup of soil, look at it under a microscope, you're going to find lots of sand and silt grains, but if you look carefully, you're going to see a whole lot of things like worms, different types of insects, and a lot of these, what we might refer to as mesofauna. They're kind of in between. They're bigger than microbes. They're not really the larger organisms, but you know, there are hundreds or thousands of these things in most soils. And here's one of the real common one, Calambula. And I think I was reading, they call these things springtails because this tail they can put down on something and use it to jump off. And I think there are about 6,500 species of these things in the world. And they estimate in a cubic meter of soil that you might have a couple hundred thousand of them. So, you know, pretty numerous. And they've got to eat, just like all of us. So they're involved in this, the whole process of organic, the plant material, and getting that eventually converted into soil organic matter. The microbes, this is an example of a fungus, a mycorrhizal fungus. And these fungi are very beneficial to a lot of plants because it's a symbiotic relationship where the fungus is on the plant root, and it helps the plant take up water and nutrients. And the benefit for the fungus is that they're not photosynthetic, so they rely on the plant to produce carbon compounds, and they use those. But this is probably very key to the survival of a lot of plant species, a lot of tree species as well. Nodules on roots makes you think of what? Legumes, which are, see these nodules here? These are where you have the bacteria that fix nitrogen, or what we call biological nitrogen fixation, where they're taking the nitrogen out of the air and converting that into a form that can be incorporated into organisms. So it's the conversion from the atmospheric nitrogen into a plant form. And finally, the bacteria. You know, these guys are maybe about the size of a clay particle, you know, 1 to 2 microns, or somewhere in there. And I think the estimate is if you take a teaspoon of topsoil, there's probably going to be about 1 million different bacteria in there, and we don't even know what most of them are. So that's where the current state of knowledge on these things is. We just know that they're important decomposers. Okay, I'm going to stop there, and you guys can take a break. And I mentioned that down in the lab, you've got the there's 5 new textures, and there's also the monoliths that you can finish looking up at. And let's do this for the test next week, which will be a week from today. Let's say everything up through what we just got done with will be fair game for the test, okay? And what we can do on Tuesday, if you haven't done so already, take a look at the old exam from, I guess it's from last year, and maybe got some questions we can talk about a little bit. If nothing else, it'll give you an idea of the types of questions that we might be asking, and just give you a general feel for what to expect.
Was that the full test that you had online?
Should be.
Because it was, I think, only 39 points. Pages.
Yeah. 39 points? Could be.
Yeah.
They're out of 50, so see, you just show up and put your name on it. You got an 11.
Yes.
Yeah, so.